He said, "Ah, shit," in his best Jersey Shore accent, because he knew what it probably was, a piece of obsolete office equipment like a printer. It had probably been thrown in a dumpster because the owner didn't want to dispose of it in an environmentally responsible way. That also meant that if Nagi tried to unload it at the landfill without reporting it and got caught, he'd get stuck with both a fine and the printer. Nagi went on with his route, had the first full load ready to go by 9 o'clock. At the landfill, he told the supervisor at the gate that he probably had a big printer in his load, and the supervisor pointed him to a specific dump area, a laborer following him with a Kubota front-end loader. Nagi dumped the load, waited for the wave from the laborer. Instead, he got the white-faced laborer running down the side of the truck calling, "You better get out here!" The printer was there, at the top of the load of foul-smelling garbage, right next to a partially exposed leg and expensive Salomon hiking boot still on the foot. Nagi crossed himself, although he was a Muslim, because that's what you did if you were raised in New Jersey. To the laborer, he said, "This ain't good. Go get the boss." The cops came, and the medical examiner. And over the span of 2 hours, the body was exposed, photographed, and recovered. The top of the torso was still wrapped in a black plastic garbage bag, which was packed away for a further forensic examination. The lack of fingertips was recorded, and the detective team working the scene noted that the body had probably been fingerprinted at some point and that the killer knew it. The crime scene crew checked the clothing for any kind of identification, but found nothing. When the cops were satisfied that they'd done everything possible at the scene, the body was moved to the medical examiner's office. There, the clothing was removed and bagged for forensics, the body examined. It bore 2 tattoos. One was a generic American flag, but the other was Special Forces with the designation ODA 331. That information, with a photograph of the dead man's face, was sent to the Army's Criminal Investigation Command, which, in the Army's idiosyncratic way, was abbreviated CID, since CIC was reserved for the Commander-in-Chief. 2 hours later, the CID came back with the information that the body was almost certainly that of former Master Sergeant James Harold Ritter, who had been subsequently identified by 2 of his former teammates. He had been honorably discharged from the Army a few years earlier. The cops found a Virginia driver's license for Ritter, matched the photos, and went to his address in Arlington, where the apartment manager told them that the apartment had just been searched by federal marshals. The cops eventually found Russell Fort, told him about Ritter, asked him about the search. Fort said, "I'll call the marshal in charge of the search and have him get back to you." By that time, an autopsy was underway at the medical examiner's office. Nagi had pointed the Alexandria cops to the Applejack's parking lot, though he couldn't tell them for sure where the body had come from. Applejack's was a good guess, but it could have come from either of his next 2 stops as well. The cops checked all 3 places, but found no evidence of a murder in any of the dumpsters. The cops found Fort more quickly than they might otherwise have because he had put in a request for all available information on Ritter. A history of being murdered was definitely information. Fort called Lucas 2 minutes after he finished talking to the cops. "Bad news, man," Fort said when Lucas picked up. "What is it?" Lucas asked. He, Bob, and Ray were ambling along M Street in Georgetown because they didn't know of a more interesting place to go. "Somebody murdered James Harold Ritter and threw his body in a dumpster. The body was found by chance, at a landfill. There's an autopsy going on right now, but the cops say he was shot twice in the chest. Best guess right now is he was killed last night. Oh, no. Ah, man. Bob and Ray stopped when they heard Lucas's tone. He turned to them and said, "Somebody killed Ritter." The killer cut off Ritter's fingertips to prevent printing, but he was identified by a tattoo from his Special Forces group, and then by matching photos with his license, Fort said. There's not a hell of a lot more unless the autopsy comes up with something. That looks like a long shot. We better get over there. We'll need an address for wherever the autopsy is. Got that for you, Fort said. And the cops want to talk to you. Listen, call the cops back and ask them to stay quiet about the murder. A couple of days. Ask for cooperation. It'd be best if this didn't make it in the papers until we've figured out what to do. I can do that, Fort said. What happened to him? Ray asked. Somebody shot him to death, Lucas said. He told them the rest of it, and they stood there shaking their heads as they heard the story. When Lucas was done, Bob looked at Ray and said, "Heavy duty, girlie." The three of them had been waiting for something to happen. They'd talked about pushing things harder, but decided in the end to wait until they had the lab results from West Virginia, which were due any minute. They had spent the previous afternoon and that morning reading everything the FBI, the Marshals Service, and the Army could produce on Ritter, Parrish, and other employees of Heracles. As they walked out to Lucas's Evoque, Fort messaged the address where the autopsy was going on. Manassas, Lucas said. I don't know where that is. Over in Virginia, Bob said. I think there was a big Civil War battle around there. Ray. I thought it was something white people kept in a jar in the refrigerator. The drive to Manassas took an hour. The medical examiner's facility looked like an elementary school, and a detective named Roger Clark from the Frederick County Sheriff's Department met them at the front entrance. He said that the autopsy was nearly over. Whoever did it probably didn't know about the tattoo, because that got us an ID faster than fingerprints would have, he said. Do you know the time of death yet? Lucas asked. Not yet, but we should know in the next few minutes. If you have the time, there's a conference room down the hall. I'd like to get a statement from you guys to put in my report. Sure, Lucas said. We'd like to know the details of the discovery. In a landfill? Any idea where the truck came from? Clark filled them in on what they'd learned and asked to record Lucas's statement. Lucas agreed and started with the accident that had killed Whitehead and nearly killed Smalls, on through to the attack on Weather and the murder of Douglas Last. He also described Ritter's background and involvement with Heracles. Wow! You think that Ritter was in on it all? Clark asked. Lucas nodded. This killing confirms it, as far as I'm concerned. The people who set this up knew we were getting close to him and couldn't take the chance that he might roll over on them. You have suspects? Yes, a number of people associated with Heracles. They are professionals, and I doubt you'd get much from them. But I can give you names if you want to go talk to them. When Clark was satisfied and had gone to check on the progress of the autopsy, Ray said, "If the locals go talk to the Heracles guys, that should give them a nasty bump." "I'm counting on it," Lucas said. "But it would have helped to have Ritter as a hammer." "The idea that we might try to use them that way probably got him killed," Bob said. "I'm not feeling too good about that," Lucas said. "Yeah, I hear you." Clark came back a few minutes later and said, "The doc will talk to us now." The pathologist's name was Benjamin Wood. He was a fleshy man with thinning red hair who asked, "Why are federal marshals chasing this one?" Because we were asked to, and we have jurisdiction, Lucas said. Did you see anything that might help? Yes, a couple of things, Wood said. He carried with him the faint but peculiar scent of autopsy rooms, something like a butcher's shop, but with noxious chemicals attached. He was shot twice. The bullets both penetrated the breastbone, one an inch or so above the heart, the other directly through it, and they made a mess of it. The slugs started coming apart as soon as they hit the victim. They were man-killers, designed to do just that. One passed entirely through the body. The core of the other one hung up on the skin of the victim's back. He was shot from the front, by the way, and there are extensive powder traces on his shirt and around the bullet's entry point, so the shooter probably wasn't more than 5 or 10 feet away, if that. Can the slugs be identified? Bob asked. That's not up to me. That's up to the forensics people. But they were in pieces, and one core is missing. What may interest you is that while one core didn't make it through the body, a few small pieces cut channels in the body and did penetrate through both the body and the victim's skin and shirt. If you can find the scene of the shooting and it was inside somewhere, a good crime scene lab might be able to find those fragments in a wall. You probably couldn't see them at all unless you looked closely. They're tiny, like chips off a fingernail clipping. The killer might not have been able to clean it up, might not even know about it, if that turns out to be important. It could, Lucas said. Do you have a time of death? There's a limit to what we can say at this point, until we get some labs back. I know that, but what do you think? He was still showing signs of rigor. He was shot last night. He's not 24 hours dead. There was more of that, but not enough to help identify the killer. When they'd finished talking to the medical examiner, they looked at Ritter's clothing, which had been separated and bagged. His wallet was missing, and a watch and ring were gone as well. They only knew about them because of the white they'd left on Ritter's tanned skin. The only thing the clothing told them was that Ritter habitually dressed in high-end outdoor garb and boots, and that he wore a heavy leather belt designed to accommodate a holster. Bob knew that because he wore the same belt. The only difference is that he wrote his name on the back of his with a Sharpie or something, Bob said, turning the belt in his hands. Probably because he spends time in a barracks, and everybody wears pistol belts. This is an expensive one. Lucas glanced at the belt, which had an elaborate James Ritter written on it in black ink, with decorative dots preceding the first name and following the last to either end of the belt. There was also an S. Must have had a lot of time to kill, Ray said. Him doing Art Deco design on his belt. Lucas told Clark, we're going to run over to his apartment, take another look. Won't need a warrant now. He'd have been driving either a Ford F-250 or a Mazda Miata Roadster. We have both tag numbers. We need to get all the local patrol guys looking for it. We'll get that out. Call you when we find it, Clark said. I need to be there when you look at the apartment, though. You're welcome to come along, Lucas said. Lucas, Bob, and Ray left for Ritter's apartment with Clark trailing. On the way, Bob said, the truck didn't look like it had been driven all that much. Maybe we should have had it processed for DNA. Ritter was probably driving. We should look for traces in the passenger seat, see who might have been sitting there. Ray said, the FBI has that fast forensic DNA analysis going now. If we can get a team over there, they can have the results back tomorrow. Not a bad idea, Lucas said. What we need is an FBI crime scene team at Ritter's to check if he might have been killed there. I'll call Fort, see if he can get one moving. After that, they can hit the truck, Bob said. We need a new Ritter. Right now, we're back to zero. Always Moore and McCoy, Ray said. Yeah, they're up, Lucas said. Fucking Ritter, Bob said. 45 minutes later, they pulled into Ritter's apartment complex, swung around back. No Miata. Probably not shot here. The killers wouldn't have driven it away, Lucas said. Fort called. Chase had gotten the crime scene team moving. While they were waiting for the FBI team to show up, Armstrong called from West Virginia. You might want to have another hard talk with Ritter, he said. We got test results back on the fabric samples from the truck, and they match the fabric samples from the logs exactly. It's apparently a kind of canvas used for martial arts mats. It's not common. Well, I've got some news about Ritter, Lucas began. Armstrong was astonished by the murder, and Lucas told him that the canvas samples were still in play if they could pull DNA out of the truck. Hang on to that stuff, Carl. We'll get back to you. I feel like we're rolling, but I can't tell if it's uphill or downhill, Bob said when Lucas told them about Armstrong's lab results. The FBI team showed up. The manager let them into Ritter's apartment, while the marshals and Clark stood around in the hall as the team took a preliminary look. An hour later, the team leader, Jake Ricardo, came out and said, "We can't find any sign of a shooting in here. I don't believe he was killed in this apartment." No murder scene. The first time the marshals searched the place, they'd been restricted by the warrant. They'd had to specifically list what they were looking for, and they'd been strictly held to that list because their justification for the search was fairly thin. With Ritter murdered, the FBI team could tear the place apart. They did that. The first significant find was two passports hidden under a carpet edge held down with a strip of double-sided tape. One passport was British, issued to one Richard Carnes with Ritter's photo. The other was American, issued to a David Havelock, also with Ritter's photo. The second and final good thing was Ritter's laptop, which was sitting on a coffee table. They couldn't get into it because it was password protected. Lucas asked them if they could get the laptop to their computer lab to break the password.
"That's in a different place down in Quantico," Ricardo said. "I'll call them and see if they can pick it up. What about his cell phone?"
"Haven't found it," Lucas said. "We know he had one because we got the number, and we know some places that it wasn't."
"When did he get killed?"
"Probably last night," Lucas said.
"What service?"
"Verizon."
"Okay. Verizon will have tracking data for him going back quite a while, and texts going back at least a few days. You gotta get some guys on them."
"Could you do that?"
"Our people can. Let me call another guy."
He did that, and then called the computer specialist at Quantico, whose name was Roger Smith.
"I live up near where you are," Smith said. "I could stop by on the way home, take a look. If I can't do anything, I could bag it and bring it to the lab first thing in the morning."
"That'd be great," Lucas said.
"In the meantime, look for the password. Could be written anywhere if he actually wrote it down. Which he probably didn't. Probably his mom's middle name."
"We'll look," Lucas said. Clark, the Frederick County detective, gave up first.
"If there's anything else here, I'll be damned if I know what it would be. I don't think he left a note that says I'm going to Joe's house and he might shoot me."
"No, but he might have left a trail to the house," Lucas said. "The FBI is looking at his phone records. Hang on a while longer. We ought to be hearing back from them." They did, but not for an hour. An FBI tech called Lucas and asked, "Do you have a cell phone or an iPad?"
"An iPad in my car," Lucas said.
"Give me your email and I'll send you a link.
We've mapped his track for the 24 hours before his phone quit.
When did it quit?
About 11 o'clock last night over in Virginia.
Where in Virginia?
There's a place called Applejack's.
That's where his body was dumped, Lucas said.
How long before I get the track?
About 30 seconds after you give me your email address.
Lucas walked down to his car, got the iPad, and walked back to Ritter's apartment, bringing up the email as he walked. The FBI file was simply a PDF of a Google map with the track played across it in a red line, with ant-sized numbers attached to the track. A legend with the map showed the time for each number. The track started at Ritter's apartment for 8 hours. He was asleep. Then touched at the Heracles office, where it stayed for a few hours, followed by a wandering line at noon. Lunch, Lucas thought. The phone went back to the office in the afternoon, went out to a location in Arlington, touched at the office, went over to Georgetown in the evening, and looped back toward Virginia, where the signal disappeared. Lucas got back to the apartment, and Bob, Ray, and Clark all looked at him. Ritter was at home last night, and he drove over to a restaurant that's about a block from Parrish's house, he said. There are some squiggles on the map where he maybe walked over to Parrish's place. The phone goes back across the river to that restaurant where the body was probably dumped. Parrish killed Ritter and drove him back across the river and dumped him.
Good to know, Clark said. That's better than Ritter driving himself back home, stopping to get a bite to eat, where he gets shot behind the restaurant by muggers and thrown in the dumpster.
That's unbecoming skepticism, Ray said. Only because the Washington area has the best defense attorneys in the country,
because it needs them. Clark said.
Ray was looking over Lucas's shoulder and said, "Call the FBI phone guy. Get Parrish's track."
"Of course," Lucas said.
He did that, and the phone guy said it would be another hour. While Lucas was talking about the phone, Smith, the computer expert, showed up. He was a balding black man who first took a long look at Ray, then used some electronic boxes to mess with Ritter's laptop. After a few minutes, it opened up. Lucas, looking over his shoulder, said, "Thank you."
"You're premature," Smith said. "Everything in here seems to be encrypted. Everything. All his email and a dozen or so documents. It's standard heavy business encryption."
He tapped the screen, showing an icon for an app called SanderCrypt. "That means there's no possibility of reading this stuff without the key."
"Well, hell, what would the key look like?" Bob asked.
"Could be anything. Might not even exist anymore if he memorized it. And of course now he's dead."
"What if he wrote it down?" Ray asked. "How many numbers would it be, or letters or whatever?"
Smith shook his head.
"Can't tell. It could be anything, but probably quite a few letters or numbers or symbols."
"And you guys can't break it?"
"Nope. The NSA can't. Nobody can."
"So let's say he wrote it down. What should we be looking for?"
"Well, anything that's sort of out of place," Smith said. "Most people don't write, 'Hey, diddle, diddle, the frog and the fiddle and the moon jumped over the plutocrat,' on the typing tray of their computer desk. If you find something like that, it's probably a key."
"We've been all over this place, inch by inch, and haven't found anything like that," Lucas said.
"Would it just be a regular sentence, though, instead of random stuff?"
"Oh, depends on how much he knows about computers. If it was that hey diddle diddle thing, and, say, 30 letters long, it'd be impossible for any computer to break through with brute force. At the same time, it'd be easy to remember," Smith said. Most non-techies don't know that, so they create a long random sequence. But random sequences are a lot harder to remember, and they get written down. That's what you'd look for. Random numbers and letters that are out of place, that don't connect to anything else. Haven't seen anything like that, either, Lucas said. Then you're SOL, Smith said. I'll take the computer. Let me know if you find anything. Maybe he's got the key in a safe deposit box or something, and you'll find it later. That seems unlikely if he has to use it, Bob said. Smith shrugged. You're right. With all the encrypted emails, it looks like he used it quite a bit. He paused, then added, We had one guy who used the serial numbers on a dollar bill. 10 numbers, 2 letters. Once forward, once backward. He told us he almost spent it a couple of times. He finally tucked it into the back compartment of his wallet to make sure he didn't. That'd be impossible to see, even if we had Ritter's wallet, which we don't, Ray said. Yeah, we didn't see it either with the dollar bill guy, Smith said. He told us about it as part of a plea bargain. Lucas shook his head. There's gotta be a way to break it. Smith shook his head. Sorry, man, there isn't. That's the way of the world now. Smith was packing up when the FBI phone technician called and said that Parrish's phone had been turned on at his house all evening. A few minutes later, the Arlington cops called and said they'd found Ritter's car a block from the Applejacks. The doors were locked, but the car appeared to be empty with no blood-like discoloration on the fabric seat. They'd tow it and open the trunk, but the Arlington cop said the trunk was more like a lunchbox than a cargo hold, and nobody could have squeezed a body inside, with or without fingertips. But there could be documents, Lucas said. I want a call back as soon as you open the trunk. We'll call, the cop said. 19. Fort ran the passports through the relevant databases to see where Ritter might have gone with them. He called back after dinner to tell Lucas that both had been used for trips to Europe and back to the U.S. He didn't stay long. 2 days in France, 3 in Spain for one of them. 3 days in France, 2 in Germany for the other, Fort said. I could be wrong, but I suspect he was validating the passports with travel. Used passports already carrying visa stamps are less interesting than brand new ones, if you're working passport control. They've already been checked. The next morning, Bob called after his workout, and Lucas told him that he was going out to walk around for a couple of hours. I need to think, that's all. Figure out what we can salvage. Like you said, Ritter was our guy, and now we need a new one. Lucas went back to Georgetown, which was close by and not a bad place to walk. He wound up in a diner, eating a short stack of pancakes with bacon, reading the Post. There was a short item on page 3 about the Smalls Grant controversy, but with nothing new. When he got the check, he paid with his last $20 bill, which was a mild surprise. He'd stopped using credit cards for small charges in unknown places. Every exposure created another possibility of getting hacked, and so always carried a supply of cash. He rarely let the count get below a couple of $100. He left the diner with $15 in change, the lack of cash scratching at the back of his brain like a weevil on a cotton bowl. And he hadn't figured out the next step. He'd seen a Wells Fargo bank a couple of blocks away and walked over. He put in his ATM card and punched in his code, and noticed the braille dots below the operating instructions. He wondered why they'd put braille on a machine where a blind guy couldn't find it easily. A bell rang in his head. He collected his cash, stuffed it in a pocket, and called Ray. Go down to the business center, however that works, maybe you'll need to take your own laptop, and download a braille chart that shows letters and numbers and print it out. I need you to figure out how it works. Braille, that is. You know, how to read it.
You mean with my fingers?
No, no. What each braille pattern means. What letters they are. The numbers.
Well, okay.
What are we doing?
Looking for the key to Ritter's laptop.
It's in braille?
Remember those weird dots on the back of his belt? Lucas asked. He heard an intake of breath.
Oh, my God, you could be right. Why don't I download it on my iPad? I can do that in a minute.
I won't have the belt in a minute, but the iPad sounds fine. I'll get back to you when I get the belt. Or we'll meet back at the hotel and work it out.
I'll download it now. The stump will be amazed, which he usually isn't.
We don't know what we've got yet, Lucas said, but this feels right. A code on his belt could be as long and random as he wanted, would be handy any place, any time, impossible to misplace, and not obvious. People who know Braille would never see it because they're, you know, blind.
Right. And people who aren't blind probably wouldn't recognize the dots as a code.
How did you recognize it? She asked.
Thought about it a lot. All the places I've seen different dot codes, Lucas lied. The Braille idea sort of popped into my head.
Someday you'll have to tell me the truth, Ray said.
With Ray going out on the net to find a Braille chart, Lucas called the Frederick County Medical Examiner, identified himself, and talked to a medical examiner's investigator named Gates.
You have a body there, a James Ritter.
Yep.
I need to come over and see his belt, Lucas said. It's a gun belt made for wide loops, like on jeans.
What are you looking at? Gates asked.
The back of the belt. There might be some information on it that we can use, Lucas said.
Really? I didn't see anything.
It's my superpower, Lucas said. I can be there in an hour.
I could take photos with my iPhone and have them to you in 4 minutes if that makes any difference to you, Gates said.
Well, yeah, let's try it. I need the whole length of the back of the belt. I'm sitting on the side of a road in downtown Washington, and I'll wait for the call.
Not 4 minutes, though, more like 7 or 8.
I'll wait, Lucas said. Lucas was waiting with his iPad when the photos came in 7 minutes later. 3 of them, all tight and well-focused, with a note that said, "From left to right, are the dots a code?"
Lucas didn't bother to answer the question, sent thanks, and headed for the hotel. Back at the hotel, Lucas found Bob and Ray waiting in Ray's room, and when Ray let him in, she waved her iPad at him and said,
"Bob and I have been figuring out Braille. It's simple enough. You still think it's Braille on the belt?"
"Sure looks like it to me," Lucas said.
He turned on his iPad, called up the photos, and they all crouched over the room's desk, the 2 iPads side by side. Lucas asked,
"How do we know which way is up or down?"
Ray explained, and Lucas said, "So you read them." She did, and wrote each letter or number on a legal pad as they scanned the belt photos. There were 24 symbols. C3CEJD24LSTPV319QUBD06G9.
That's nothing but a key to something, Bob said.
Lucas fought through the FBI bureaucracy to get on the line with Roger Smith, the FBI computer tech.
"Do you have Jim Ritter's laptop handy?"
"It's in a lockup, but I can get it in a minute or two."
"I got some numbers for you," Lucas said.
"Hang on."
Lucas hung on, and Bob said to Ray, "If this works, I'm probably going to have to kiss Lucas's ass. You might not want to be here for that."
"No time for it anyway," Lucas said. "If this works, we need to get down to Quantico and check this stuff out."
Ray, "Why? We'll just have him email it to us."
Lucas rubbed his face and sighed. "Shit. You know, deep in my heart, I don't understand that we don't always have to go places to get things anymore," Lucas said. "I was about to drive an hour over to the medical examiner's office to look at Ritter's belt. The investigator sent me the iPhone photos in 7 minutes. Kind of skizzes me out the way it comes out of the sky now."
Smith came back to the phone, said, "We're up and running. What's your best guess?"
Lucas read the string of numbers and letters to him, and the tech typed them in and said,
"Nothing."
"Maybe it's backward or whatever," Lucas said. "Or maybe I mistyped something." "I'm going to read them back to you," the tech said.
He did, and toward the end of the string said, DD06G9.
Lucas said, "Wait, wait. Toward the end of the string it should be BDO, not DDO.
The tech said, "Wait one," and then,
"Shazam, we're in. I could come down and look at it, but if you could send the stuff, it'd be a hell of a lot quicker."
"I can send it. What's that chick's name, the one working with you?" Smith asked.
"You mean Ray?" Lucas looked at Ray.
"Yeah, the pretty one, the basketball player."
"Ray," to Ray quietly, "he kinda likes your looks."
"Well, naturally," she said.
"Smith, give me her email and yours. I'm going to send her a string like the one you sent me. A different one, of course. And I'll send all the texts and emails in one long file to your email. We'll keep them separate so nobody can see both at the same time. You'll need to enter the code to read them. It's a one-time code. Nobody else will be able to use it after you do, not even you. Of course, if you open the files on your computer and save them in plain text and somebody takes the computer away from you, they've got it."
"I'll open it on my iPad. I got Touch ID," Lucas said.
"Didn't this Ritter guy lose his fingers?" Smith asked.
"Yeah," Lucas said.
"I won't do that."
"Give me Ray's email."
"Don't hit on her," Lucas said.
"Hey, I'm with the FBI. Fidelity, Bravery, Integrity. FBI.
Smith said it would take a while to put a file together, and they sat and restlessly watched a Nationals game for 25 minutes. Then Lucas's iPad dinged and the file came in. A minute later, a string of letters and numbers came in for Ray.
"Hey, Sugar Bun, I'd GR8LY like to take you out for a drink someday."
"That can't possibly be the code," Ray said.
"Bob, sure it is. Remember what he said about using regular sentences as keys? And what Lucas told him about hitting on you? He's delivering the encryption code and hitting on you at the same time."
"He's not a bad-looking guy either," Ray said.
"Tall, intelligent."
"Bald," Bob said.
Lucas said, "Jesus, Ray, just type the fucking thing into my file."
She did, and the new file opened up. 12 documents and 30 emails.
"Not much," Ray said.
"Ritter was disciplined," Lucas said.
"Probably cleans out stuff he's not using."
"Even though he knows we could never crack the encryption without the code?" Bob asked.
"Even then," Lucas said. "If you got something you don't need, get rid of it."
He thought about the Ritter bank statement he'd flushed. But Ritter wasn't perfectly disciplined. The longer files contained details of shipments to Libya, Niger, and Iraq from Heracles,
there were no details of what the shipments might be, that Ritter, McCoy, and Moore would be escorting to their final destinations. There were names of recipients and places mentioned, along with notes on briefing times and, occasionally, enigmatic labels that seemed to Lucas to be cautionary. Mazik is reliable and knows his way around, and he's always got protection, both physical and political, so you'll be okay there. And you can't count on Jibril to back you up if push comes to shove, which it won't. Be aware that he's belonged to 4 different militias that we know of, and they're not friendly with each other, so he's a guy who's willing to change beliefs like he changes his shorts, if he changes his shorts. Another one said, "Every time the cases are out of your sight, check the seals when you get back. Even when you get off the plane. This shit can't get pieced out or we're in trouble." The third one said, "Beware the OGA. They're thick in there." "I wonder what the OGA is," Lucas asked. "I know that," Bob said. "It stands for Other Government Agency, which means the CIA. "Got it." "The FBI needs to see this," Ray said. "What about the emails?" Most of the emails were cryptic. They came in from several people at Heracles, but mostly said things like, "We still on for 2? Then they found the maps. Lucas clicked on an email titled, "Here," and when he opened it, found 2 satellite blow-ups of tight areas of West Virginia. One had a dot on what appeared to be the intersection of a dirt lane and a back road less than 0.5 mile from Smalls's cabin above the south branch of the Potomac. The other displayed a path that went from the point of impact, where Ritter's truck hit Smalls's Cadillac, to the back road above the cabin, to the spot where the logs that had been on the side of the truck were dumped. They all read it, half disbelieving, until Bob tapped the screen where the trail intersected with the back road. "This is a scouting report setting up the attack. Somebody was set to watch Smalls here. When they left the cabin, he would call Ritter in the truck and walk out to where the truck was going to pick him up, here. He'd be picked up, and they would drive out to the place where they dumped the logs. After that, it was over the hill and back to D.C. "Look at the timestamp," Lucas said. "It was, what, 5 days before they hit Smalls? They must have been watching him and knew he'd be going up there with Whitehead." "You don't get that just by watching," Ray said. "They bugged him." The email had gone from Moore to Ritter. Lucas said, "We need to tell the FBI guys about this. Then we go bust Moore. He's toast. We got our new guy. The only question now is, do we put him in a cell or wire him up?" He fought through the FBI bureaucracy again, finally arriving at the desk of Jane Chase's assistant. The assistant said that Ms. Chase was in a conference. Lucas said, "This is quite important. Go into the conference right now and tell her the U.S. Marshals are calling with information she'd want. She'll know what you're talking about." The assistant hesitated, then said, his voice pitching up with mild exasperation, "Well, I'll do it, but I hope you're not getting me in trouble." "I promise I'm not." 2 minutes later, Chase said, "Hello? Agent Chase, this is Lucas Davenport, the U.S. Marshal from the meeting." "I remember," she said, her voice dry as desert sand. "What do you want?" "You're aware that one of our targets, James Ritter, was murdered?"
"I was informed of that, yes. Your man Fort called.
We seized Ritter's laptop."
"Which I understand is heavily encrypted."
"Yes. The other marshals and I cracked the code this morning. We have a number of documents about shipments from Heracles to Libya, Iraq, and Niger, although it doesn't say what the shipments were. But it looks to me like it might be stuff they don't want anyone to know about, From our perspective, the more important document apparently locates a suspect named Moore at Senator Smalls's cabin and also pinpoints the location where the logs we found with paint from Smalls's Cadillac on them were dumped. We're thinking of busting Moore right away. The question is, do we drop him in a cell or see if he'll wear a wire for us? Or might the FBI have a different idea altogether?
Wait, you cracked the encryption code? I was told by experts that couldn't be done, she said.
Yeah, well, what can I tell you? We're marshals. After considering that, she said,
I'm jammed up in the early afternoon, but I'll clear my schedule for later on. Be here at 4 o'clock. You'll be met in the lobby. Bring the documents you've found with you. We'll have some of our specialists look at them.
Lucas told her that the computer guy at Quantico could have them to her in 7 minutes, and she said,
Excellent. I will retrieve them from him. Your diligence is to be commended. We'll see you here at 4.
She hung up, and Lucas said to Bob and Ray, There is a woman not just with a stick up her ass, but an entire fucking tree. With branches. Ray said, You gotta be straight to get as high up as she is with the Phoebes.
Like you, Lucas said.
Ray said, Nah, I just gotta be willing to shoot any dumbass motherfucker stupid enough to run from me, which I am willing to do. And I have to take care of the stump, of course.
For which I am eternally grateful, Bob said.
Lucas checked his cell phone. 4 o'clock. 3 hours. Maybe I'll work out. Too hot to go shopping.
Take a nap, Ray said. Or I could drive down to Quantico and meet Smith for a drink. He could give me a back rub. I could use a good rub.
Bob said, I've been thinking...
Ray.
Uh-oh. You know what I told you about that.
What's the S on Ritter's belt?
Lucas said.
What?
There's an S right at the end of the code. If the dots are a code, maybe the S is, too.
Lucas got out his iPad, called up the photos of Ritter's belt.
Bob was correct about the S, written in the same black ink as the Braille dots, although Lucas was not certain whether the symbol was actually an S. The initial, or symbol, or whatever it was rendered in open-ended double parallel lines with one side of the initial symbol shorter than the other.
It's more like a shape than an actual initial. It's like an S-shaped road, Lucas said.
That's dumb. Who'd have to remember an S-shaped road? Ray asked. What good would it do you?
Maybe a river? Lucas suggested, and Ray shook her head.
They sat and stared at it for a while, and Lucas said, Fuck it. Let's think about it.
A second later, Bob said, You know what it looks like? It looks like the trap under a sink, like maybe some place you'd hide something small, a thumb drive, for instance.
Ray and Lucas looked at each other, back at the iPad, and Ray said, God damn it, we didn't look.
Now we've got to go back over to Ritter's and be back here by 4.
On the way, Lucas called Russell Fort, told him about the meeting with the FBI. Fort said he'd be there, and O'Connor would probably come along to add weight. When Lucas finished the call, he made another to the manager at Ritter's condo complex, asked if they had a maintenance man. They did.
We need him to do some plumbing, Lucas said.
The maintenance guy, a phlegmatic man with watery blue eyes, was waiting for them when they arrived. He said they might not have seen everything, but they'd seen most of it, no longer curious about why 3 feds in suits showed up to have him take a sink apart. They started in the kitchen, found nothing in the trap. In the bathroom, he looked at the trap and said,
This has been taken apart a few times, but not by me, and I'm the only one authorized to do it.
The maintenance man took off the looped section of the pipe, stuck his finger in it, and popped out a plastic tube about the length and diameter of Lucas's little finger.
The ends were wrapped in tape. He handed it to Lucas and said,
"Radiator hose tape. So water can't get in. Couldn't put it in the kitchen because garbage going down could push the tube along and clog the sink. Nothing goes in this sink but water, soap, and whiskers."
While the maintenance men put the sinks back together, Lucas borrowed Bob's Leatherman tool to cut the tape off the plastic box. That done, he pulled the box apart and took out a flat, odd-looking key.
"Safe deposit box," Ray said. "This should be good."
Lucas called Fort. "I need a couple of clerks and another warrant, and I need them in a hurry." He explained, and Fort wasn't sure they'd need the warrant because Ritter was dead, but decided that having a warrant when they didn't need it was better than needing a warrant when they didn't have it.
"I'll write it up and get it."
The clerks started calling banks in the area, using three names, Ritter's own and those on the two passports they'd found under the rug. One of the clerks found a David Havelock at a city bank a half mile away. Fort wasn't much farther away than that at the Marshal Service headquarters and said he would meet them there with the warrant. Lucas said, "Let's go," and they were out the door and into the heat. They arrived at the bank ahead of Fort, got to the branch manager, and told her what was about to happen.
"The warrant's fine," she said after looking at their IDs, "but I'll need to call a man to drill the lock."
Lucas took the key from his pocket. "We have Ritter's key, and also the passport he used to get the box under false pretenses." The woman looked at the passport and the key and muttered,
"Yeah, it's one of ours. It's a big box. I think I remember this gentleman. He's a nice-looking fellow."
"Not so much now," Ray said.
Fort showed up, sweaty yet well-dressed, and produced the warrant.
"You know, I don't do this so much, come to the scene. I'm more of an intellectual than a street guy."
"We all know that, but it never hurts an office guy to add to his street cred," Ray said.
"Hadn't thought of it that way," Fort said. "I should start packing heat."
They all looked at him, and he added,
"Okay, maybe not."
They followed the manager into the vault, along with the women who managed the registry and safeguarded the master keys. The box opened on the first try. The woman pulled it out, said,
"Heavy. Let's take it to a viewing desk."
The desk was in a private niche. They sent the bank people away, gathered around as Fort popped the top, looked in, and Bob said,
"Oh, boy."
The box was filled nearly to the top. The first layer, 6 or 8 inches thick, was a mass of documents in English, French, and Arabic.
"Contracts for delivery," Ray said, thumbing through them.
"Guns. Oh, my God, anti-aircraft missiles."
Ritter was keeping the docs for self-protection, his cover-your-ass files, just in case, Lucas said.
"Looks like it's gonna work, too, if we're right about who killed him," Ray said. "Maybe not for self-protection, but revenge."
Under the first layer was a thin, flat plastic box identical to those that Lucas had for his fishing tackle. Inside were 2 dozen thumb drives. The third layer consisted of cash, $100 bills and 500 euro notes, and gold coins, and 3 more passports. They did a quick count of the cash and an estimate of the gold, and Fort, looking at his cell phone calculator, said,
"He was looking for a rough equivalent of $1 million in cash. The 500 euro notes make it more compact."
The 80 gold coins added a bit more than $100,000 to the total. Ray went back to the lobby and got a cardboard bank box from the manager. Fort filled out a return on the search warrant, signed it, the manager took it away to Xerox, and then they put everything inside the box and carried it out to Fort's car.
"Got 30 minutes to get to Hoover," he said. "We could be a bit late, especially if I drive slow, and I will."
Holy cats, $1 million in the footwell. Maybe I'll be really late,
drive out to Reagan and get on a plane to Panama. Think about the wife and kids, Bob said. Fort said, that's what I was doing.
20. Fort's boss, Gabe O'Connor, was waiting for them outside the Hoover building. He saw the box that Fort was carrying and joked,
money?
Fort said with a straight face, over $1 million, we think, though we didn't have time to work out the exchange rate on the euros or the current price of gold. O'Connor looked from Fort to Lucas to Ray to Bob and back to Fort.
Are you shitting me?
Might not be the most important thing, Lucas said. We took it out of Ritter's safe deposit box. There are a lot of CYA docs in there, apparently about illegal weapons sales.
You guys find interesting cases, O'Connor said.
He looked at his watch.
Let's go. Russell, talk to me about this while we walk up. I don't want to be late, but I don't want to be the complete dumbass in there either.
Fort started talking and didn't stop, even when their escort showed up. He talked fast and in paragraphs, Lucas thought. If you'd typed out what Fort said, you could have published it as an essay. He continued all the way to the conference room, with O'Connor nodding steadily like a bobblehead doll. The conference room was still empty, like the first time they were there, until Jane Chase and her retinue of suits showed up, Chase carrying a thin aluminum attaché case. As they were arranging themselves in their chairs, Fort stood up, plunked the mass of documents on the table. He followed that with the thumb drives and passports, added the stacks of cash, and finally the pile of gold coins, and sat back down.
Where did you get it?
Chase asked. Lucas smiled, rubbing his nose as cover. They weren't asking how much, or even saying, oh my God, but instead, where did you get it? The gold and cash weren't enough to impress this particular bunch of bureaucrats. Fort looked at Lucas and said,
you talk for a while.
Lucas started with Ritter's laptop and the encrypted documents, explaining how the code had been concealed, though openly, on the back of Ritter's gun belt. Then he explained Bob's sudden comprehension of the S design on the same belt and finding the safe deposit box key. One of the suits with Chase, a woman, said to Bob,
you thought it was a drain? Why would you think that?
Bob said,
well, it looked like one. The design.
The woman said, I don't think I've ever looked at a drain pipe.
Probably not a do-it-yourselfer, Bob said. I've looked at quite a few of them. They're kind of interesting if you really get your head around them.
The woman said,
huh.
Lucas explained that they hadn't had time to go over the documents from the bank, but it looks like Ritter was accumulating material that would give him some protection if Heracles, for whatever reason, ever decided to sell him out, Lucas said. There's a lot of stuff about arms sales, including anti-aircraft missiles, and the implication seems to be that the sales were illegal, or at least irregular.
What are you planning to do with it? Chase asked.
I was planning to give it to you, Lucas said, all of it. And Chase showed a tiny smile of satisfaction. We have a particular focus, the assassination attempt on Senator Smalls. If you could have your legal people process this stuff quickly and give us an idea of the ramifications, we'll use it to confront a couple of the guys who were involved in the deliveries. We need to turn them. It'll have to be swift. They know we're coming right now, and they've already lined up attorneys for the main suspects. We've talked to two of them, and they told us to go, you know.
Go fuck yourselves, Chase said crisply.
Exactly, Lucas said. We didn't have a lever.
Who do you want to go after?
Chase asked,
specifically.
Four names, Lucas said. You have them all. Claxon, Parrish, Moore, and McCoy. We think we could bust Moore right now with a good chance that it would stand up. If you looked at that map in the encrypted documents...
Yes, I did, Chase said.
That was the ambush at Smalls's cabin.
Exactly. You might get him with that and with the other circumstantial stuff, but it's thin, she said.
Which is why we need somebody else to